Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today I'll be reading from Where We Live, Architecture and Historic Preservation, that's the Fall 2020 issue, Volume 60, Number 1. And we're going to start with Two Houses Inside the Museum. It's an article by John M. Campbell. And John is the collections manager for the North Carolina Museum of History. He's been on staff since 1992 and has enjoyed the great diversity the museum has in its collections and exhibits. Inside the Museum of History's exhibit, The Story of North Carolina, there are two full-size houses, the 1742 Robson House from Pitt County and the 1860 Purvis Cabin from Martin County. Early in the planning for this exhibit, the museum's curators, these are people who study the artifacts and objects in the museum's collection and help create exhibits about them. The museum's curators decided that they wanted visitors to be able to get close to the structures and really examine how they were built and what furnishings they might have contained. This encourages visitors to think about what life might have been like for the people who lived in them. What you see today in the exhibit is a result of many years of work to document, dissemble, take apart, move, and then put the buildings back together inside the exhibit. This article is a little peek into that process. Robson Wichard Taylor House. Let's start with the elder of the two, the Robson Wichard Taylor House. It is believed to be the oldest surviving home in Pitt County and one of the oldest houses in the state. The house was built in 1742 by a carpenter named Solomon Robson. It is typical of houses owned by middle-class eastern North Carolina farmers. Originally, it had one room and a loft. Another room was added on in 1750. Some remodeling has been done, but this mid-1700s house retains many original elements. Braced frame timber construction reflects English building traditions characteristic of early dwellings. The vertical wall boards and exposed ceiling beams are original. So is the flooring of the loft above. Some 18th century handmade nails remain in the walls. If you look closely, you can detect traces of early whitewash. The house has seen a lot of history and many structural changes over the years. Solomon's granddaughter sold the house to Reuben Moore in 1806. 40 years later, newlyweds William and Mary Wichard purchased it. Their daughter married into the Taylor family. That family owned the property until 1986 when preservation efforts began. The Historic Preservation Foundation of North Carolina Incorporated became the next owner. Staff there enlisted the North Carolina Museum of History to exhibit the house in Raleigh. The Pitt County Historical Society provided much of the funding for the moving, fumigation, and restoration of this county and state treasure. One of the first decisions to be made by staff: how much of the later and upstairs additions should be displayed in the museum? To help make that decision, a historic structures report was commissioned to assist with the restoration. The documentation, drawings, and photos helped the curators and historic preservation experts determine how much of the original structure to keep for display. To prepare the Robson House to be moved, a moving contractor dismantled the additions and stripped the house down to its original two rooms from 1750. For a few years, while the story of North Carolina was being prepared, the house was stored in an aircraft hangar. Finally, when the gallery was ready, a professional rigging company was hired to move the structure to the museum. Some of the glass in the lobby had to be removed so the dwelling could be brought in. Fortunately, the house was already in several large pieces that just barely fit through the gallery doors. The story of North Carolina is so large that it needed to open in two phases or steps for staff to complete the work. The Robson House is in the first phase, which opened in May 2011. To get the house ready to receive visitors, Rudrich Restorations Incorporation was hired to help. The company put the house back together and created all the missing pieces to give it a finished look. Now visitors can walk through the two rooms and think about life in North Carolina during the 1700s and 1800s. The Purvis Cabin. The second home is a frame structure built in 1860 in Martin County by laborers enslaved by A.J. Purvis. Seven enslaved African Americans lived in this 15-foot by 17-foot one-room house in 1860. Two men, one woman, a teenager, a girl, and two toddler boys. Living, eating, and sleeping all in the same room, they had no privacy and very little elbow room. Historians didn't know whether any of the adults were married or if they were the biological parents of any of the children. But they do know that people who lived together in this way probably became like family through their shared life and responsibilities. In 1993, with the assistance of the Eastern House of Historic Preservation, W.E. Purvis donated the dwelling, which was on his family land, to the museum. He recognized how important it was historically and feared that the upcoming road widening would cause it to be destroyed. To expedite the removal, the museum hired an architect to oversee the move. In December 1995, museum employees slowly and systematically removed the later additions to the house. Then they dismantled the house. They even numbered each board to make it easier to assemble later. The house was placed in the second phase of the story of North Carolina, which opened in November 2011. It became the centerpiece of the section on slavery and antebellum life. Antebellum means the period before the Civil War. Once the exhibit floor was ready, the restoration contractor, Rudrich Restorations Incorporated, was brought in to figure out the jigsaw puzzle of all the numbered boards. They also provided replicas of the missing pieces, roof and stick chimney. The North Carolina Museum of History is now proud to be the home of these two diverse, historically important dwellings. The Purvis Cabin allows one to gain a perspective on the lives of the enslaved people who lived in it. The same could be said of the Robson House, which invites each visitor to contemplate the life of an Eastern yeoman farmer's family. These structures play a large role in the interpretation of North Carolina history within this gallery. Here are the captions for the photographs that accompany this article. The Robson Wichard Taylor House has been restored and is on exhibit inside the North Carolina Museum of History. The house was built in 1742 by a carpenter named Solomon Robson. It is likely the oldest surviving house in Pitt County and one of the oldest in the state. The Robson House circa 1980s with several alterations. It took a lot of expertise and a lot of people being very careful to move the pieces of the Robson House into the North Carolina Museum of History in downtown Raleigh. A dwelling that housed enslaved people circa 1993 in Martin County, with additions and porch on the front. Located on a Martin County farm, this dwelling was literally right beside a highway that was soon to be widened. In 1995, a camera captured the interior of this house before it was taken apart and moved to the museum. Museum employees worked to dismantle the dwelling piece by piece to relocate it to Raleigh. Each board in the structure was labeled and numbered to make it easier to reassemble the building at the museum. Image of the interior of the restored Purvis Cabin as it appears on exhibit at the North Carolina Museum of History today. The next article is Log Buildings, From Early Settlements to Rustic Retreats, by Annie Laurie McDonald, who has worked in the field of historic preservation since 2000. She has authored or co-authored six National Register of Historic Places nominations and a National Heritage Area feasibility study, as well as Leesburg, Then and Now, Arcadia Publications, 2011. Since 2012, she has served as a preservation specialist for the 25-county western region of North Carolina's Historic Preservation Office. When you think about log cabins, what comes to mind? Is it a movie or television show in which someone lived in a log house? Is it a historical museum that you visited with family or a school group? Perhaps it's a building in your hometown that you pass by sometimes. If it's a building that you visited or seen in person, what do you know about it? Do you know who built it and when it was constructed? Are you familiar with other log buildings? If so, what do you know about them? And how can they help you better understand the history of the communities they are in? Log houses are some of the earliest buildings to have been constructed across North Carolina as Europeans immigrated to the area and created new settlements. Building with logs continued to be a preferred construction technique for many families through the 1800s as the newly formed nation expanded westward. Settlers erected log houses using traditional building practices handed down through generations. What did these houses look like in the 1700s and 1800s? Their layouts followed fairly standard formulas, with each space defined by four log walls called a pen. A house with one large room with four log walls is a single pen house. Some builders chose to divide that large room into two smaller rooms by adding a wood partition wall on the inside. This was done in the Irvin Hamrick log house in southwest Cleveland County. Such a partition often provided separation between a bedroom or private quarters and a kitchen living area or a public space. These single pen log houses, whether composed of one large room or divided into two rooms, were heated by a single fireplace. In the case of a single pen log house with a partition wall, the fireplace was usually located in the kitchen living area rather than in the private quarters. Some of these houses also contained a set of stairs leading to a second story or loft under the roof that served as sleeping quarters. Larger log houses from the 1700s and 1800s were often double pen structures, meaning that they were composed of two rooms constructed wholly of logs. These houses might have a single chimney on one end of the building or a chimney on both ends, like the Robert Cleveland Log House in Wilkesboro, Wilkes County. Because double pen houses typically required more resources and time to build, they suggested a family's increased wealth. Some larger houses featured a large central chimney between the two log rooms, with a fireplace opening into each room. These are commonly called saddlebag log houses because of the way the rooms straddle the central chimney. Other two-room houses are called dog trot log houses because the two rooms are separated by as much as 6 feet with a continuous roof line that shelters the open space between them. Dog trot houses typically have two chimneys, one on each end of the building. Whether single pen, double pen, saddlebag, or dog trot, log houses of the 1700s and 1800s were built of hand-hewn and hand-sawed logs. Once the builders cut down a tree, they cleaned the log of bark and used hand tools to hew, cut down by blows of an axe, it into usable lumber that was roughly square. These logs were then joined at the corners using special notching techniques, which ensured that the walls would hold together. Like the size and the configuration of the house itself, the specific notching method used suggested the owner's or builder's means and status. While full dovetail notching was the strongest way to fasten the logs together, it was rarely employed because of the skill necessary to cut the logs for a proper fit. Instead, builders more commonly used half dovetail notching, which was also strong and required less skill. The third most common joinery method in log houses of this period was V notching. If logs did not fit tightly together, there was space in between them. To correct this problem, the space was filled with a combination of materials. Rocks, sticks, and bits of sawn wood made up the chinking that was placed between logs to take up space. The chinking was then set in place with daubing, which is typically a mixture of mud and straw that dried to create a mortar between the logs. Because daubing was easily eroded, causing the chinking to fall out. Many of these log buildings were originally covered with wood siding to protect the chinking and daubing between the logs. Later, as popular interest in log buildings increased through the 1900s, the wood siding was often removed from these buildings to reveal the rustic appearance of the hewn logs. The removal of the siding, which was intended to protect the material underneath, typically resulted in the erosion of the daubing, which was then replaced by more modern mortar or concrete. The construction of hand-hewed, squared log houses became less common in North Carolina's more populated areas through the 1800s as these communities became more established. Rail transportation increased, building technologies advanced, and property owners wanted their houses to reflect the popular forms and styles that changed with each passing decade. Yet the use of hand-hewed log construction continued in rural areas across North Carolina throughout the late 1800s. Why? Many rural areas across the state, and especially in the mountainous western region, were still remote, without easy access to rail transportation and mass-produced commercial goods. In the early 1900s, a new type of log building became popular across North Carolina. Inspired by the log houses of the 1700s and 1800s, these new log buildings were rustic and considered fashionable at the same time. While earlier buildings constructed of hand-hewn logs according to traditional building practices were erected out of necessity using available materials and labor, these newer log structures were built because they evoked a nostalgia for tradition in a modern era. Nostalgia is a mixture of pleasure and sadness that is caused by remembering something from the past and wishing that you could experience it again. Common features of these early 20th century log buildings include exposed round logs rather than hand-hewn squared logs. Their notching was often different as well, employing a saddle notch with lime mortar or concrete used to fill the space between the logs. Additionally, they did not necessarily follow standard building layouts such as the single pen, double pen, saddlebag, or dog trot forms. Instead, these new log rustic revival log houses displayed a wide range of building forms that depended on their intended use. In addition to the typical placement of chimneys on the ends of the house or in the middle, as seen in earlier log buildings, these new log dwellings were heated with fireplaces that might be located elsewhere in the building. And, unlike their antecedents, early 20th century log houses were occasionally designed by architects. One of the best preserved and largest examples of a rustic revival style log building in North Carolina is Glenchoga Lodge in rural Macon County. Erected in 1935 and used as a tourist lodge, Glenchoga Lodge is a later version of the building type as the style's popularity increased during the Great Depression. While Glenchoga Lodge is a large and picturesque example of a rustic revival log building, far more common are smaller one-story examples of these log dwellings in cities, towns, and rural areas across the state. Less common but more notable are the tourist courts, built in the 1920s and 1930s. Capitalizing on the public's nostalgia for log buildings of the 1700s and 1800s, these tourist courts emerged during a time of increased automobile use by an emerging middle class interested in affordable vacation retreats. These tourist courts featured collections of rustic log buildings for lodging and associated buildings. Documented examples of rustic revival-style tourist courts are few. One of the best examples is Foster's Log Cabin Court in Woodfin in Buncombe County. Foster's is a remarkably intact collection of 18 tourist cabins, a restaurant, and a former bathhouse that were built from the 1930s through the 1950s and are still used as tourist lodging. The largest collection of rustic revival-style log cabins in North Carolina is located at Homeland Park near the intersection of Swannanoa River Road and Tunnel Road in East Asheville. Approximately 40 log cabins were built at Homeland Park between 1932 and 1940. The property continued to serve summer tourists through the mid-20th century, even as modern strip motels featuring swimming pools and dining facilities came into fashion in the 1950s. During the post-World War II development boom across the nation, Americans more often favored the sleek, streamlined design of modernist architecture or the traditional features of colonial revival-inspired design over the nostalgic architecture of rustic revival-style log buildings. Yet, many of these buildings and tourist camps remain across North Carolina today. Together, the hand-hewn log buildings of the 1700s and 1800s and the rustic revival-style log buildings of the early 1900s represent a continuous thread of design and construction rooted in natural materials adapted to the needs and styles of their times. The next article is Appreciating the Outbuilding by Jennifer Cathy, who is a restoration specialist with the North Carolina State Historic Preservation Office in Asheville. Look beyond the farmhouse or the city houses of the pre-1950 era, and you'll find a wide array of outbuildings that supported all manner of domestic and agriculture life. Outbuildings are small buildings such as barns or woodsheds that are separate from, but important to, the main house. Outbuildings are of great interest to preservationists and architectural historians because they tell the story of how people lived and worked, and how, like a machine, places operated. Any machine has several or more parts, all function together to perform a specific task. Apply the idea of a machine to the pre-1950 domestic landscape, and you start to identify different components of the landscape that supported essential functions, like production and storage of food, processing of household items, and care of livestock and machinery. Any house in the city or the country is a place for living, eating, sleeping, and socializing. Look beyond the house and you will find outbuildings that supported tasks associated with the house and family, or that supplied the household, or that related to agricultural production. Many outbuildings are made of wood, brick, or stone. They are usually smaller in size than the main dwelling house, and they are directly associated with supporting and supplying the home. Food processing buildings associated with the earliest North Carolina households and through the 1800s include freestanding kitchen buildings, ice houses, and smokehouses, all supporting food preparation and storage needs. Additionally, a well or spring house and a freestanding laundry building served washing and dining functions. By the 1900s, some of the functions of these buildings were absorbed into the main house. For example, cooking and laundry work came to be done under the roof of the main house. But new outbuilding types appeared. In North Carolina's mountain counties, wood and stone apple houses were built to store the harvest from home orchards, and can houses used to store homegrown and home-canned fruits and vegetables. Other very specialized outbuildings were used, such as the weaving house, a wood frame building made to house looms for the production of household textiles. Domestic outbuildings also supported the household's transportation needs. Earlier houses may have featured an outbuilding to store the family carriage and stable for horses and mules to pull them. With the coming of the automobile age, the carriage house gave way to the freestanding garage building. While the primary use was to store the motor car, in-town garages very often contained an upper-level residence for domestic servants or staff, such as a maid, chauffeur, gardener, or handyman. Farm landscapes typically possess a similar array of domestic outbuildings, such as multiple outbuildings associated with the shelter of livestock and the storing and processing of farm goods. The size and number of outbuildings depend on the scale of agricultural operations and special needs associated with particular crops. Probably best known and most recognized among agricultural outbuildings is the multipurpose barn, most often a wood frame building with gable or gambrel roof. The multipurpose barn is characterized by an open runway that functions as a workspace and shelters machines and equipment. The runway is flanked by stables or secure storage areas for grains. A hayloft occupies the space above the runway and under the roof, a warehouse to store hay needed to feed livestock through the winter months. Aside from those of the multipurpose variety, barns often take on very specialized forms and functions. With the adoption of flue-cured and burley tobacco varieties in North Carolina, log and wood-frame barns were developed for the curing of tobacco leaves. Farmers adopted large gambrel-roofed barns for feeding and milking large dairy herds, and for their huge capacity for upper-floor hay storage. The prospect for preserving domestic and agricultural outbuildings depend a great deal on the size and locations of the building and also the creativity of people to adapt them for new uses. Many city dwellers occupying 19th century homes with carriage houses and early 20th century homes with freestanding garages have rehabilitated those outbuildings into guest cottages or rental housing. Some business people have transformed a handful of big multipurpose dairy and hay barns into event venues. The runways becoming public corridors. The granaries, corn cribs, and stables adapted for offices and meeting rooms. And the hay lofts transformed into cathedral-like spaces for parties and weddings. Here are some of the captions of photographs accompanying this article. The carriage house at the Octavius Koch residence, West Harrogate Street in Raleigh, once housed the family's horse-drawn carriage. Today, many people house their family vehicle in an attached garage, like the one for this ranch-style house. The covered old well on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, circa 1892, served as the campus's sole water source for many years. An example of a kitchen outbuilding at the Christmas Green Newell House in Warrenton, Warren County. Curators study photographs for historical clues, and so can you. Here's an example of a typical family photograph. Check the background. Can you find any outbuildings or historic buildings? The site is the Edward J. Stiers House in Germantown in Stokes County. The Rob Benton Joyce Farm is on Means Creek Road in Rockingham County. How many outbuildings can you find in this photo? Postcard, 1918, titled Spring House Along a Mountain Road in the Land of the Sky near Asheville. And finally, Red Barn Along the Blue Ridge Parkway near Blowing Rock. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Please be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.